everyone. We are back for yet another episode of the Hauenstein Center's podcast series, Off the Stage. My name is Maddie Miller. I am the media specialist for the Hauenstein Center. And today is my second interview of the day with Teresa Cardinal Brown, Senior Advisor for Immigration and Border Policy at the Bipartisan Policy Center. Teresa, thanks for joining me.
Glad to be here, Maddie.
I heard that you had some travel issues, but tell us where you are traveling from today.
So I live and work in and around Washington, D.C. The Bipartisan Policy Center is a Washington, D.C. based think tank. I personally live just outside of D.C. in Northern Virginia.
Awesome.
But yeah, I've traveled here via Chicago and a little bit of a delay due to fog, but I made it just in time.
We are so glad to have you here. Thank you for enduring those travel pains.
No problem.
Teresa is here for our bipartisan policy panel on immigration that we are hosting tonight. So by the time you're listening to this podcast, the event has already happened, but you can go to the link in the description to listen to a recording of the event on YouTube or in podcast form. And I'm anticipating that's going to be a great conversation. So you should definitely check that out. Teresa, we are going to do our BOQ bowl of questions. Oh. So feel free.
All right. So I will make sure that the people can hear me feeling for a question down in here.
Yes, okay, there perfect.
We go. So the first question is, what is my favorite holiday and why? Oh, that's an easy one. Oh, it is good. Christmas.
Okay.
Actually, it's the entire season from Thanksgiving through Christmas.
Yes.
And that is primarily because my mom was one of those moms who just went over the top.
I love to hear it.
So, you know, Thanksgiving, starting like leading up to Thanksgiving, the house would start transforming.
Yes.
And, you know, she had, you know, a special set of dishes, and we had all the linens that changed out, and then, you know, food and cookies and candies, and then Christmas itself, she always managed to find, like, more presents than the year before. And so this is a tradition that I carried on when I got married and for our kids. And now my daughter, God love her, who's 27 and living on her own, is also in the over-the-top Christmas category.
Love it.
You know, we collect new holiday ornaments every year for our Christmas tree. Yeah, that's definitely the favorite holiday season in my household.
Awesome. So I have to ask you the famous Christmas question. Mm-hmm. How early do you put up your tree? I'm curious.
We actually don't put up the tree. It kind of depends year to year.
Okay.
And whether we're doing a real or an artificial tree.
Oh, interesting.
We prefer to do a real tree if we can. And then we try to put it up a little bit later because we like to have it a little longer after Christmas. But if we're traveling or if we're not able to do that, we'll put up the artificial tree fairly early in December. So I would say the tree is almost always up by middle of December.
Okay, cool. And how about Christmas music? How early is too early
now,
for Christmas music?
I am a purist on that.
Okay.
Christmas, no Christmas music until after Thanksgiving.
After Thanksgiving, okay.
And I absolutely, if I can, I will wait until December 1st.
Okay,
And actually, I would love to listen to Christmas music through, like, Epiphany, which is, like, the 6th of January, but almost all the stations, because they start it, like, in October.
So early,
they stop the day after Christmas. I'm like, I'm not ready yet!
Yeah, that is so true. I like that too. I like the idea of Christmas, like Christmas Day, not being the end of the Christmas season. Like, I would love to see it, you know, especially now we have snow and, you know, actual snow and stuff.
Yeah.
So,
the Christmas lights outside our house are the last thing to come down, and that can be the end of January, honestly.
Exactly. Awesome. Loved that question. Let's do one more.
Okay.
That was like, more? I feel like that question was made for you.
maybe it was. Maybe it was. It was an easy question for me to answer.
Yeah.
Because we just had our holiday season.
Yeah.
Mac or PC? Oh.
Oh.
So this will age me.
Okay.
Because my first computer was neither.
Okay.
We had a Commodore 64.
Commodore. I don't even think I've heard of that brand.
Yes. So before there was a Mac or PC, there was something called a Commodore 64, and it was basically there was an Atari computer. So the people who made the very first gaming systems.
Yeah. Okay. I know
made
Atari.
Computers.
Yeah.
And they ran on BASIC. And this was when I was in elementary school. The first real computer I worked on was a Macintosh. It was actually the Apple IIc.
Okay. Wow.
You know, as I said, I'm dating myself, like the early days of computing. I didn't have a computer when I went to college. They still had typewriters, but they had created these typewriters that had a very, very small memory so that you would type a line of text and you could edit just that line in like this little LCD display.
Yeah.
And then when you hit enter, it would literally type it out on the paper.
Oh my gosh.
That's very awesome. Early word processors. Yeah. But the computer had a computer, the university had a computer lab that mm-hmm. had Apple computers.
Yeah.
So that was what I used in university. Mm-hmm. And then my first job had Macintosh computers. But okay. after that, every place I ever worked had a PC.
Okay.
And so that's what I'm proficient on now.
Okay. So now I was going to ask, what do you have
I am
right now?
Fully a PC person. Okay. My daughter wanted a Mac when she went off to college, mm-hmm. and I got her one. And then she would call me and say something was going wrong. I'm like, I can't help you. You're going to have to go to the computer lab yeah. and have somebody else help you.
That's so funny. Yeah. We, in our office, like at Grand Valley here, we're allowed mm-hmm. to choose Mac or PC, but I would say a lot of the software and stuff is made for PCs.
Yeah.
So naturally, like having a Mac, I always have like tech issues, I'm just so used to a Mac so that it's just hard for me to have anything different.
So I'm a PC person.
Okay. Love to hear it. Well, awesome. Well, thank you for doing our BOQ questions.
No problem.
So I always love to start off these interviews, just like hearing about where you grew up, where are you from? What were you interested in when you were in school growing up, and what were you like as a child, basically?
What was I like as a child?
Yeah.
My little brother would say I was his second mom, and he hated that. my mother would say I was either precious or precocious, depending on what mood she was in.
Okay.
so I guess I always had a little bit of a something about me.
Yeah.
I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. Mm-hmm. And then I went to college at the University of Delaware.
Awesome.
President Biden's alma mater.
I didn't know that.
And I studied international relations.
Okay.
And economics. And I will be perfectly honest, like probably a lot of undergraduate students, I chose that field of international relations just because when I was in high school, I really enjoyed learning languages. So I took French and German.
Yeah.
I had traveled to Europe after high school and really enjoyed that. We hosted mm-hmm. foreign exchange students. So I knew I had to do something international. So not knowing what else to choose as a major, I chose international relations. And I really did enjoy it as an undergrad, but I had no idea what I was going to do with this degree.
Yeah.
So at that time, again, dating myself, when you graduated from college and when you were looking for your first job, you would go to the Sunday paper and you would open it up to the one ads. And I literally would open the Washington Post to the one ads, because we were living in Washington by that time. And I would circle every job that had the word international in it, no matter what it was. And I just applied to everything.
Yeah.
But the job that I got, my first job out of college, was with a company, a very small company, that evaluated foreign educational credentials to see what their U.S. equivalent would be.
Oh.
And the reason they did this was mostly for the purposes of that person getting a visa to come to the United States, because mm-hmm. some of our immigration categories, particularly employment-based immigration, require you to have a degree or its equivalent. So mm-hmm. I was looking at somebody who graduated from an Indian engineering college in 3 years. Is that equivalent to a 4-year bachelor's of engineering in the United mm-hmm. States? And you would look at the courses they took and the level that they were taking, and if there was a practicum, mm-hmm. and then you'd actually go back and look what secondary education was, because mm-hmm. some countries have 12-year or 11-year or 13-year that pre-university level education.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was what we were doing. But we were doing it mostly for immigration attorneys and their clients. So I learned immigration law because I had to know that what we were doing met the legal requirements for the visas.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so that's how I got involved in immigration. And after a couple years of doing that, it was, I was like, well, what do I do next? And the mm-hmm. obvious answer was go work for the attorneys.
Yeah.
So I became a paralegal, and I worked for the next 6 years at law firms in DC, filing all different kinds of immigration cases for all different kinds of people. I worked on asylum cases. I worked on immigrant visas for business people. I worked on family sponsorship, naturalization. Some of my most interesting cases, I did a green card for a clown for the Ringling Brothers Circus.
Wow.
I did an asylum case for a professional hockey player from Eastern Europe.
Okay.
I did a lot of visas for engineers and people in high mm-hmm. tech, and wrote very nice letters to the Immigration and Naturalization Service describing what they did, even when I didn't understand what it was.
Mm-hmm.
So that was where I really got sort of involved in immigration law. And mm-hmm. it was during the early 1990s, and immigration law was changing fairly regularly during that time. So one of my jobs was to keep up with the new rules and changes and regulations. So I had a lot, I'd gained a lot of background understanding and the legal framework. And I was, it was then that I was trying to figure out, do I go to law school or do I do something else? And one of my attorneys that I was working for said, you should go work in immigration policy. And I thought about it for a while, and I'm like, well, that kind of makes sense. I could go do that. And so then I, that's how I turned to policy. So I got a job working as a immigration advocacy associate at the Immigration Lawyers Association. I started lobbying Congress. I started meeting with members of the government, writing comments to regulations. I then went to work to U.S. Chamber of Commerce for a number of years. After that, next step was I went into government. So I worked at the Department of Homeland Security. I worked at Customs and Border Protection. I worked at DHS headquarters on immigration and a lot of other things. When I came back out, I did consulting for a little while, and then I joined my current organization, my think tank, 10 years ago.
So that's awesome.
That's my career in a nutshell, which hopefully lets your listeners know that not most often you don't have a plan, and your career, you never know where it's going to take you.
Yeah, that's literally what Aaron and I were talking about on the podcast this morning. Like, you just never know, and that's really cool to just hear how one thing kind of like leads to another and whatnot.
It really is, and you know, at the time, at each time when I was looking at a new job or potentially getting a new job, I didn't know what I was going to look for. I didn't know whether I was going to get it. And sometimes I jumped into jobs, I'm like, I don't know if I really know what I'm doing. And I learned a lot on those jobs. Yeah. So, you know, for anybody who's listening to this, who's in college right now going, oh my God, how am I going to plan the rest of my life? Yeah. The answer is don't plan the rest of your life, plan the next thing you're going to do. And then worry about the next thing after that when it's time.
Yeah, that's great. That's really, really good advice. One thing that you said during that was you were, you've always kind of had to pay attention to how immigration policy has changed. Do you remember like a specific change or a specific policy that came out that was like really monumental for like just what you do?
Yeah, so when I first started at that educational credential firm, Congress had just passed a law in 1990 that really reconfigured a lot of the immigration system.
Okay.
And so because it was brand new law and the agencies had to write brand new regulations to implement the law, I was charged with sort of following that process and learning it. And what I found was that the attorneys that we were working with had been working under the old system for so long, like decades, that this new law was kind of confusing to them. Well, I didn't have anything to unlearn. So I was just learning. So I found myself explaining to them what the new changes were and what they meant. And so I was doing policy at that point in time. I just didn't know what that's what I was doing. But really, it was because I came in completely blank slate, it was easier for me to pick up the new rules. But talking to them, I understood what had changed and why. And so I had this really interesting position of being able to look back and look forward and really see how much of a change that law made to the system at that time. Now, you know, 30 years on, that law seems antiquated. And that's one of the things we're going to talk about tonight, probably. Like, that's the last major change to our legal immigration system was 1990, when I was just starting out, and I'm now 15 years old.
I'll bleep that out.
That's fine. It's fine. I own it. But, you know, it's no longer really relevant. It's obsolete in many ways, and yet we really need Congress to fix it, because Congress is the only one who can change it. And that has really, that's the root of a lot of the issues that we see today, is that nothing's been updated in so long, because people just can't figure out what they can agree on to do.
Well, that probably goes into your work at the Bipartisan Policy Center, like exactly what you guys kind of are focused on. You mentioned before we started that you also have a podcast.
I do.
So I would love to hear what's the name of your podcast, and when did you start it, and what do you guys talk about?
So our podcast is called This Week in Immigration, and it comes out every 2 weeks. We try to discuss literally sort of what's the latest in the news on immigration, what you may be reading about in the newspaper, what Washington D.C. is talking about. We try to get behind the headlines a little bit.
Yeah.
But we also do episodes where we just sort of try to talk about an aspect of the system. So the latest podcast we recorded, which will be out next Tuesday. I'm not sure when this podcast released. Yeah. Anyway, one of the latest episodes you can listen is all about the refugee system. And we talk with someone who's a president of one of the agencies that resettles refugees in the United States.
Cool.
And then we talked to another person at a research organization who's been looking at the data, because we had a very significant decline in the number of refugees resettled from overseas during the Trump administration. It's now starting to kind of grow back again. And so we wanted to see what has happened in those intervening years. So that's the kind of conversation that we have. We have over 160 episodes now. We've been doing it for since 2017.
Wow, that's really cool.
Yeah, so we started out just sort of testing the waters. We did an initial sort of 5-episode run of what you need to know about immigration, which was a bunch of explainers about different aspects, but we enjoyed doing it so much. And I call it the little podcast that could, because even though the Bipartisan Policy Center supports us, it's literally been a crew of just like one or two people that's always made it happen. We've had as people have come and gone from the BPC, we've had changes of hosts. I'm kind of the continuity.
Yeah.
But, you know, they've been really good to keep us going. And when COVID hit, we all figured out how to record from our homes and on makeshift microphones. I now have a podcast and boom mic in my home set up so I can record from home.
That's awesome.
And all of those kind of things. But I've really enjoyed it. I've been a podcast listener for a very long time.
Yeah.
I've always enjoyed listening to podcasts. Mm-hmm. And again, dating myself, I didn't have an iPod, one of the earliest iPods. I actually listened to podcasts on an old Palm Pilot, which, if any of your listeners remember what
I don't know what that is.
Back when you either had to download it directly to your computer and then transfer it over to your device. So
that's awesome. That's so cool to hear, because I think, like, in my brain, I think of like podcasts like just in the last like 3 years. You know, that's when they became popular, but they have been around for a long time.
One of the podcasts that I listened to, I was just listening to this morning, is a podcast called Coverville. And it's literally a music podcast of covers of songs.
Yeah.
And this guy has been doing it for 20 years.
That is incredible. I love that. That's so cool. And you kept saying, like, we talk about, like, who's we? Like,
so
who do you do it with?
So it's me and usually another part of the immigration team at the Bipartisan Policy Center who's the host. And we either, you know, they ask me questions, and sometimes I'm sort of the interviewee.
Yeah.
Sometimes I'm the interviewer, and I invite colleagues on the podcast to talk about the work that they've done. Research, you know, again, news of the day, perspectives. Yeah. We've had members of Congress on. We've had people from the administration on. Mm-hmm. We've had researchers and experts, immigration attorneys, immigrants telling their stories. It's just been a wide variety of things. Yeah,
that's cool. Well, for those listening, I will definitely link that podcast below so you can check that out.
Yeah.
So I asked Aaron this question this morning, and so I'm like, I think I'm going to have to ask all three of you panelists this, because it was just a great conversation. But this year, our How and Science Center programming is all focused around the idea of empowered citizenship. So that is like our theme for the year. And obviously tonight's event fits perfectly into that, thinking about how we can empower others to, you know, be citizens of our country, of our world, our communities, make our world a better place. So I was just wondering what your thoughts are on the idea of empowered citizenship, how it applies to the work that you do, you know, at the Bipartisan Policy Center, but also just in your personal life as well.
Well, I think that's a great phrase, empowered citizenship. You know, being a citizen carries rights and responsibilities.
Yeah.
And I think we tend to, at least lately, I feel like we've had a lot of conversations about our rights as citizens, but we kind of forget about the responsibilities. And one of those responsibilities is to educate yourself about the policies that our government at every level are undertaking. What are they doing? Why are they doing it? What is the problem they're trying to solve? Is their solution going to work, or do they think it's going to work? What are they doing with our taxpayer money? One of the things that I really learned when I worked inside government, which I really wish that everybody who's advocating on any sort of policy had the opportunity to work inside government, because it's such a different perspective. I remember when I took the job at DHS, one of the reasons I did so was I felt like I had spent the last 8 years of my career sort of advocating for changes in policy, I said, it's probably incumbent on me to go into government and actually try to make policy and see how hard it is. Mm-hmm. And what I found is it's really hard. It's a lot easier to be on the outside and tell the government what it ought to do than be on the inside of government to try to do it.
Okay.
Our government is not designed to work efficiently. That sounds awful to say.
Yeah.
But there's lots of reasons for that.
Okay.
Our government has evolved over time because we want our government to represent everybody's interests. Our government should not be representative of only one part of the people or should only listen to one part of the people. Yeah. And so we don't want our government necessarily making snap decisions that don't take into account everybody's interests. We don't want our government being able to spend money willy-nilly, right? There should be controls on that. And so really the role of being inside government is balancing those interests. I had to listen to everybody who came to talk to me, whether I agreed with them personally or not. I worked in two different administrations. I started working in the George W. Bush administration. I left during the Barack Obama administration. They had very different ideas about a lot of issues, but yet my job as a government employee was to represent those issues and balance them with the interests of everybody else that I heard from. And that was really enlightening because it gave me a perspective that I didn't necessarily have before I went into government. And that's one of the reasons why I ended up coming out and going to a place like the Bipartisan Policy Center, because I really learned the importance of listening to everybody. Because everybody's perspective is important, and they can bring to you a perspective that you may not have yourself.
Yeah.
And so when you're making policy, one thing I will say is that any policy, whether it's a law Congress passes or a regulation that a government does or even a program that's being implemented, guarantee, because we're all human doing this, it will have unintended consequences.
Yeah.
And so you have to have some humility to say, this is what I think is the right thing to do right now after listening to all of you, but we'll see how it works when we actually try to do it. Mm-hmm. And maybe when we try to do it, we find that it has a different outcome, and then we need to be willing to revisit that. I wish in some ways that our policymakers brought more of that humility to their role.
I see.
And I think one of the things that empowered citizens can do is bringing some of that, maybe I think I have the right answer, but maybe I don't. Maybe there's somebody else I could listen to that has a different perspective, and then we could figure out where the right answer is. Because I guarantee you, there is nobody who has all the right answers, mm-hmm. right? We do best when we have what we used to call it the BPC. We still do, but our former president used to say this. The best policy comes from the constructive clash of ideas.
Yeah.
So there's three pieces to that. Mm-hmm. It has to be constructive. Just yelling at each other and saying, my way, the highway, or I'm right and you're wrong, or you can't do this, is not going to get you anywhere. It has to be constructive. In other words, you both have to be trying to actually solve the problem.
Yeah.
Then it has to be a clash. Like, differing ideas, when brought together, can maybe develop a third idea that you hadn't thought of. Mm-hmm. The other piece of this is it has to be ideas. Mm-hmm. These have to be actual, real things that you are trying to do, not an opinion, not a position, but an idea to solve the problem. I feel like right now we're in a place where we tend to yell a lot about the problems, and we don't focus on what the solutions are.
Yeah.
So that's really what I think, you know, involved citizenship should be. All of us should be looking for the solutions, mm-hmm. not just yelling about the problems. Everybody can yell about the problems. We can focus on the problems till we're purple.
Yeah.
That's not going to solve them until we actually start focusing on solutions. Mm-hmm. And then we have to, like, listen to all the solutions out there and then figure out what the right ones are.
For sure.
And probably that means coming together, and some of column A and some of column B and some of column C mm-hmm. is going to get you where you need to go.
For sure. I love that solutions-oriented outward focus. I think that's awesome. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Cool. Thanks for sharing that.
You're welcome.
I have two more questions for you. So sure. The second to last one is just curious, you know, what is your life outside of work look like? You know, what do you like to do for fun? What's your perfect Saturday? What are your interests? All of that.
Well, my kids are grown. I still have one living at home, and she has all of her own interests and almost none of them are mine. So she's off gaming or playing cards or doing other stuff with her friend. My husband is retired and he always wants me to spend more time with him going out somewhere, whether it's traveling or out to dinner or we take our dog on dog ventures to the park or wherever. We both love to ski.
Awesome.
He is trying to get me to like golf. Hasn't succeeded yet.
Okay.
Part of it is, even though we've been married 30 years, we're very compatible, but he is an extrovert and I'm an introvert. And my day job requires doing stuff like this, talking to a lot of people all day long. Yeah. So on weekends, I am very happy to curl up behind in front of the fire, read a book or watch a movie. Yeah. And he's like, I've been at home alone all week. I want to go out.
Go somewhere.
So we're navigating this right now.
Sure.
But I do like to read, but I almost always read nothing that has to do with work.
Yes.
I spend all day reading news and articles and policy documents and academic papers. And so when I get home, I'm going to read fluff.
Yeah.
So I read murder mysteries and sci-fi novels and fantasy books and stuff like that.
Yeah. Love that.
And that's me.
Read any good fantasy books recently? I'm curious.
Well... We started watching the Wheel of Time series on Amazon Prime, and I had started reading that when I was in college. It's a 14-book series.
Wow.
And I never finished it.
Yeah.
But after watching the TV show, I'm like, I'm going to try this again. Okay. So I literally spent the last year reading all 14 books.
All 14.
Books.
So I'm taking would you a break. Recommend it?
I don't know.
Okay.
I will put it this way. I'm glad I'm done.
Yes.
I'm glad I did it.
Okay.
But there were lots of parts of those books. Well, I think the whole series could have been shorter, and there are parts of the books that we would just call a slog to read through.
Okay, yep.
So you have to be willing to put up with the slog.
14 books, that's a lot to keep a plot going,
It is. And it's one of those, like, Game of Thrones or Lord of the Rings, where, like, there's lots of things happening simultaneously.
Yep.
So you get, like, we haven't heard from that group of people in three books, and now we're back to them. What happened to them last?
Awesome.
Anyway.
That makes me think of my favorite series when I was younger was A Series of Unfortunate Events.
Yeah.
Which was like a 13-book series. Yeah. But they were short books and stuff.
These were all, by the way, over 800 pages.
Oh, my gosh. Like, these are like Harry Potter like
More
size.
Than, yeah.
Oh, my word.
Yeah.
That's I'm very proud of you for getting that done.
It's an achievement. It was an achievement.
That's awesome. Cool. Well, the last question that I always end our podcast with is asking our guests, what is your advice for someone who maybe wants to go to a similar career path as you?
I think I'll go back to what I said
and
earlier.
I was gonna say, you shared a lot of great advice already, so I'm like.
But I will say, you know, don't worry so much about what your first job is.
Okay.
What your, you know, like, take the job that comes to you. Like I said, I looked at anything that had international in it, and it just so happened that first job set me on a career path. You don't know whether that first job will be that for you, or maybe you will take that job and go, oh my God, I never want to do this ever again.
Yeah.
And that's okay too. You've learned something.
Yeah.
The one thing I would tell any young person starting out is you will learn something from every job you're in. You will learn a subject matter. You will learn a work environment that you work better in or work worse in. You will learn how to work with people who are very different from you, whether that's your boss or your coworkers. Mm-hmm. You will learn what kind of supervisor you do or don't want to be when you get to that point, or if you ever want to be a supervisor.
Yeah.
There's so much things that you learn after you're done with school.
Mm-hmm.
School is the foundation. But most of your learning will take place the rest of your life. Every job you're in, learn everything you can from that job.
Mm-hmm.
And then you'll know when it's time to move on.
Yeah.
You will know. You'll kind of go, I got this. I want to do something different.
Yeah.
I tell people when I hire people in my work, this is my timeline. Because everybody comes in like, I want to do this job perfectly from day one. Like, No. I don't expect that of you.
Mm-hmm.
I think it's going to take you 6 months to figure out what the job is. Mm-hmm. It's going to take you another 6 months to do the job well. And then the next 6 months, you're going to make this job your own. Mm-hmm. And you're going to figure out how to do the job better and make it a better job. Mm-hmm. And then that's when you have succeeded. So my timeline is different from yours. And don't hold yourself to something higher. If you can find a boss that will give you that space and you can give yourself that grace, take it.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's great advice. I feel like you're like talking to me. I'm like, I'm going to take that advice. That's awesome. Well, Teresa, thank you so much for being on the podcast. We are so excited to have you at our event tonight.
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Yes. And for those listening, I will link Teresa's fellow panelists off the stage episodes in the description, along with the link to find the podcast or the YouTube of the immigration panel event that we are hosting tonight. And thank you so much for listening. Thank you for listening to Off the Stage Podcast, a series produced by the Hauenstein Center for Presidential Studies at Grand Valley State University. The Hauenstein Center, inspired by Ralph Hauenstein's life of leadership and service, is dedicated to raising a community of ethical, effective leaders for the 21st century. For more information on our center, our Cook Leadership Academy, or our Common Ground Initiative, visit our website at www.gvsu.edu/hc. To keep up with our current events and reoccurring initiatives, you can follow us on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, or LinkedIn, all of which can be found linked below. If you liked this episode, consider giving us a review or rating so we can be found by other podcast listeners. Again, thanks for listening to Off the Stage Podcast.